and we did not know if there would be anything left of our lives when the hurricane passed. Our grief only increased with each revelation about Dylan. Immediately after the shootings, we went to one of the therapists recommended in a letter from the county coroner. Tom and Byron went a few times, but soon came to the conclusion that the sessions weren't helping. I stayed with it longer, though the therapist and I were barely scratching the surface of my pain. He seemed overwhelmed by our situation and by the magnitude of what we were dealing with. He read the papers, watched the news, and surfed the internet to gauge the world's reaction. When I walked into a counseling session, he would swivel away from his computer and allude to the threats made against us in the press or online. I was trying to insulate myself from that kind of fear and negativity, so these reports made me anxious. I'm sure the therapist was simply concerned about our safety, but at times he seemed considerably more preoccupied with the external factors around us than with my emotional state. We did a few exercises to deal with grief, such as writing letters to Dylan. But Tom and I could not begin the hard work of facing the loss of a child. How could we? We were swept away by the madness engulfing us. Our grief for Dylan was buried under the difficulties of living with the life he had created for us. It was becoming increasingly clear, too, that Tom and I were going in different directions with our pain. Tom's a born entrepreneur with none of my innate caution, always happy to dig into a new project without stopping to worry about how difficult or expensive it will be to complete. I'd fallen in love with his creativity and had been enthralled by his risk-taking and lack of fear. We had always been strongly attracted to each other, and we shared the same sense of humor. Who you are dictates how you proceed through the grief process, though, and the extremity of the situation we were in began to highlight how different Tom and I really were. Tom was looking for an explanation. Bullies, the school, the media, Eric. None of that made sense to me, although I was still maintaining some level of denial about the degree to which Dylan had been involved. It was easier for me to believe he had been crazy, or even evil, than to pretend anything he'd experienced could justify what he'd done. While I took comfort from our visitors, Tom found it easier to be alone. It seemed to me that he wanted to control the lawyers working with us, whereas I was painfully aware we were out of our depth and felt grateful when a professional with expertise could tell us what to do. Our marriage had been successful for almost 30 years because we complemented each other. But after Columbine, we couldn't seem to agree about anything. We were both riding the same roller coaster, but we were never in the same place at the same time. If Tom was sad, I was angry. If I was angry, he was sad. I'd always been able to brush off Tom's cranky moods and to laugh at his colorful rants. When you're grieving in such an extreme way, though, your tolerance for stress is diminished. It was like the skin had been flayed right off of me, leaving no layer of protection between me and overwhelming emotion. In my journal, I wrote, "Tom's words sound like a jackhammer to me, even those uttered most quietly. His thoughts are never aligned with mine. They always come from far away, and they're totally foreign to my thinking." Our relationship with Byron was strained, too. He'd moved back home several weeks after his brother's death. By that time, he'd lived in his own apartment for 2 years and had grown used to being independent. Tom and I couldn't stop wringing our hands and prying into his personal life. We thought our failure to pry into Dylan's had caused Columbine. But we were barely rational, a point brought home to us one night when Byron went out to dinner with a friend. The weather was bad, and Tom and I couldn't sleep for worrying about the treacherous conditions on the winding roads leading up to our house. We finally heard Byron's car pull into our drive around 11, but he didn't come into the house as we expected. Instead, we heard strange clinking sounds from our garage, and then his car pulled out again at top speed. We panicked. Our heads were filled with worst-case scenarios: weapons, drugs, suicide, theft, murder. Had Byron come home for a hidden gun or other contraband? Had he stashed illegal materials in our garage? Should we call the police? 20 minutes later, over the sound of our pounding hearts, we heard Byron's car pull in at a more leisurely speed. He was badly startled to find the two of us, wild-eyed in our pajamas, waiting for him at the top of the stairs. The proverbial hooves we'd heard had been a horse, not a zebra. On his way home, Byron had passed a car that had skidded off the slick road. He'd come home to get a chain from the garage so he could help the other driver out of the ditch. After that night, I extracted a promise from him that he would never intentionally hurt himself or anyone else. I was surprised to find he needed the same reassurance from me. We were beginning to fall into the complicated pattern that would define our relationship in the years after the shootings, even as we became closer than we'd ever been. I'd encourage him to talk about his feelings, but when he confessed to despair, rational under the circumstances, I worried he'd harm himself. It was a terribly unfair position to put him in. I was asking him to reassure me he was okay. Really, I was asking him to be okay, when of course he was not. It would take us a long time to find a way to talk about our devastation, while assuring one another we were still committed to life. In reality, I'm not sure we were. On many days, dying seemed easier than living. All three of us talked about death, ashes, epitaphs, the meaning of life. Tom said he knew what his last words would be. Thank God it's over. Journal entry, May 1999. I read mail for 5 hours, crying nearly the whole time. 2 boxes now, one from the post office and one from the lawyer. So many cards and letters of love and support, and yet one hate letter and I am shattered. Much has been written about the need most people have, in the aftermath of a tragedy like Columbine, to assign blame. Whether it was the scale of the tragedy or the senselessness or 1,000 other reasons I can think of, Columbine became, and remains, a lightning rod. People blamed video games, movies, music, bullying, access to guns, unarmed teachers, the absence of prayer in schools, secular humanism, psychiatric medication. Mostly, though, they blamed us. To me, that made sense. If I had been sitting in my living room, shaking out the pages of the freshly delivered Rocky Mountain News with Dylan bagging up the kitchen garbage behind me, and Byron happily and untidily ensconced in his apartment across town, I would have blamed us too. Didn't I wonder about a criminal's family whenever I heard about a terrible act of violence? Didn't I think, what on earth did the parents do to that poor child so he could grow up to do something like that? A child raised with love in a loving home could never have done such a thing. For years, and without a second thought, I'd accepted explanations laying the blame squarely with the criminal's family. Obviously, the parents had been oblivious, irresponsible, secretly abusive. Of course, the mother had been a shrew, a smotherer, a doormat. That was why I was so surprised when people we'd never met began to reach out to our family in sympathy for our loss and for our predicament. It is also why I have such esteem and appreciation for the victims' families who reached out without blame. They cannot know, as I do, what it is to be the mother of a killer. Yet they are able to operate from a place of compassion. That is remarkable to me. It is something I am not sure I would have been able to do. Just days after the shootings, our lawyer handed us a cardboard box containing a hand-painted ceramic angel, a frozen dinner of cream chicken and biscuits, and a few condolence cards, all gestures of sympathy from people we had never met. That trickle of consideration turned into a stream and then a flood. People wrote from all over the country and the world. All they needed was our name and Littleton, Colorado on the envelope, and their words and gifts found their way to us. A lot of the mail came from people Tom and I had known at various times in our lives. Elementary school classmates, teachers, co-workers, and former students. Some were from families in the area whose kids had known Dylan, sharing their memories of him. I read those many times. Lots of the letters were from strangers, though, and a great many of them were anonymous. We received prayers, poems, books, plaques, toys, children's drawings, and handmade objects. People made charitable donations in Dylan's memory. They sent cash and checks, which we returned. People from all walks of life wrote to us, clergymen, attorneys, teachers, social workers, policemen, United States Marines, and prisoners. The generosity was astonishing. People offered legal services, confidential talks, massages, and private cabins where we could hide from the press. A great many people wrote to tell us they were dismayed to see local memorials held for 13 and not 15 victims. They wrote to let me know their own religious organizations or social groups had remembered all 15. At concerts where Dylan's name had been read out with the names of the other victims, or masses where prayers had been said for his soul. I was grateful for those letters. For me, there had been 15 victims. Although I understood the response in my own community, it was still hard for me to accept that Dylan's entire life had no value at all because of what he had done before he died. It had been reported extensively in the media that Dylan and Eric had been bullied, and so we received letters from people of all ages who had been bullied in high school. I did not know Dylan had been bullied, and the shock of needing to readjust my image of him was extreme. Regardless, I was moved by the letter writer's descriptions of the blind rage, depression, and helplessness that result from feeling so powerless. One young man wrote, after sharing his own high school experiences of being afraid to go to the bathroom or walk the halls, "I'm not surprised it happened. I'm surprised it didn't happen at my school, too, and that it doesn't happen every day at schools across America." Young people wrote directly to Dylan, pouring out their sorrow and hatred for their own school culture, and I wondered if anyone around them knew of the grief they were carrying inside. Many of the people who wrote shared personal experiences of loss. Some wrote about their own family's experience with mental illness and suicide. Those letters helped me tremendously, as did the ones where parents and grandparents shared stories about hardship and humiliation caused by a family member. A minister wrote to share that his son was serving a life sentence for murder. I read that letter often. One of the many things I felt guilt about in the wake of the tragedy was my fear that I had failed to impart a proper religious education. I had taught Dylan right from wrong every minute of the day, but we hadn't regularly attended a church or a synagogue since the boys were small. It was silly. A single example was no kind of sample size. Yet I took great comfort from knowing that in this one instance, at least, regular Sunday school hadn't been enough to stop a child from making a terrible choice. Our lawyer assigned a member of his staff to go through and remove any hate mail or death threats. Despite his efforts to shield us, we did receive hate mail, and one negative letter obliterated the positive effects of hundreds of supportive ones. One letter writer demanded in black marker, "How could you not know?" It was, of course, the question I asked myself day and night. I had not imagined myself to be a perfect parent by any stretch of the imagination. I did, however, believe my close connection, and not just to Dylan, but to both of my sons, meant I would be able to intuit if something was wrong, especially if something was very wrong. I would never have told you I had access to Dylan's every thought and feeling, but I would have said with confidence that I knew exactly what he was capable of, and I would have been wrong. "There, but for the grace of God, go I," one mother wrote. She was living with a violent, mentally ill child, and described eloquently how she woke up every day dreading a phone call bearing terrible news about her son, like the one I had received from Tom. It was a sentiment many others would echo over the years. One letter offered prayers of support and was signed, "From a Death Row Mom." We received a few letters from the families of victims of other shootings. One man's son was killed in junior high school, and he eloquently shared his initial feelings of outrage, pain, and numbness. That letter gave me a little insight into what the victims' families might be suffering. People wrote who had lost a child, like the young mother whose toddler suffered a fatal head injury when she fell within reach of family members. Those letters enabled me to connect to the part of me that was simply grieving Dylan. Of course, we heard from many people who had lost loved ones to suicide. I couldn't yet fully understand Dylan's death as a suicide, but those letters helped me to begin. I would later have the opportunity to meet many of the people who wrote. Though we were isolated from our local community in many ways, these letters helped me to feel kinship with others on a global scale. Many more people than I'd ever imagined had experienced extreme hardships and loss. There was a devastating amount of pain out there in the world. It was as if we had tapped into a deep wellspring of universal suffering. I wondered daily at people's compassion and at their generosity. One card read simply, "God bless your family," in the painstaking and shaky handwriting of a very elderly person. And I marveled at the enormous and possibly painful effort a stranger across the country had made to get the card and the stamp, to write the note, to mail it, just so I would not feel so alone. These were people with an emotional bandwidth, a depth and breadth of understanding that had come from pain in their own lives. Unfortunately, it was still too early for me to take comfort from the stories of their survival. I still did not believe there would be an after. Like so many things that happened to us after the shootings, there was no way to respond normally to the mail we were getting. I responded personally to the first notes and intended to continue, but the boxes of mail came and came and came. My grandfather had once written a thank you note in response to a particularly beautiful thank you note he'd received, so this failure to acknowledge the generosity of people who'd reached out landed hard with me. I hated the idea that people who had taken the time and made the effort to express sympathy would go without thanks, but I simply couldn't keep up. I stacked the letters around us, filling plastic bins to sort and organize them, until they took over our family room. I developed a triage system to prioritize those requiring a personal response, with people who had shared their own despair and suicidal thoughts at the top. I responded to many of the letters, but it was only a small percentage. I stopped counting cards and letters when they reached 3,600, and they continued to arrive long after I was no longer counting. My guilt was amplified by the scathing criticism we were receiving from every quarter. We were pilloried daily in the press, often for decisions I didn't even fully understand. For example, our attorneys advised us to file our intent to put the sheriff's department on notice, a routine legal strategy to keep our options open if new information about the case became available. Through it all, we would maintain a positive working relationship with the sheriff's department, continuing to communicate and eager to help in any way we could. But the stories in the media came quickly after the decision and made it seem as if we were going to sue the sheriff's department for what our son had done. News stories like this one drew an astonishing amount of vitriol. "Those parents are disgusting," one person seethed on a talk radio broadcast I accidentally heard while changing radio stations in my car. "People thought we should be jailed, hunted like animals, tortured, shot. I still can't look at comment sections of articles about Columbine." I was never able to escape the humiliation and fear that such remarks left behind. I'd always thought of myself as a good citizen and a good mother, and now I was being paraded through town as the worst parent who'd ever lived. For the first time in my life, I was living as an outcast, judged and rejected by others for circumstances over which I had no control. Dylan had unwittingly provided an opportunity for us to understand how he must have felt during the last years of his life. We lived in a small psychological space following Dylan's death, one in which we were still attentive, well-meaning, loving parents who had lost our son. The only way we could survive was by minimizing our exposure to the negativity, and so we withdrew. Every time someone attempted to speak on our behalf, their words were twisted and misrepresented in the media. So we surrounded ourselves with friends and locked ourselves away from the rest of the world. We did not respond to even the most egregious accusations. I am not sure refusing to engage was the best strategy. Our failure to speak up in our own defense made people believe we were hiding secrets. It felt and still feels wrong to let untruths stand, especially since many of the misconceptions about our family and how we raised Dylan are perceived to be true to this day. Journal entry, May 1999. I'm tired of being strong. I can't be strong anymore. I can't face or do anything. I'm lost in a deep chasm of sorrow. I have 17 phone messages and don't have the energy to listen to them. Dylan's room is just as the law enforcement people left it, and I can't face putting it in order. During our first days back at home, we had made disjointed efforts to reclaim the house, but Dylan's room remained as the police had left it, with his possessions spilling out onto the mezzanine and his stripped mattress leaning against the upstairs banister. In the month after his death, I began to make daily forays into the room, putting a few things in order before the strength of my feelings overwhelmed me and I had to flee. I lingered in particular over Dylan's bathroom sink. Wisps of his blonde hair remained in his comb, and his whiskers filled an electric razor we'd bought him. It wasn't only the strength of my grief that held me back from doing more. Every time I disinfected a surface or laundered a hamper of dirty clothes, I was destroying traces Dylan had left behind. The idea of erasing him broke my heart, and I worried that with every emptied wastebasket, I was losing opportunities to understand the last hours of his life. Of course, the investigators had taken everything they thought might be relevant, but I was still searching for answers in the wreckage he left behind. I was no closer to understanding what he had been thinking and feeling, or how the kid I loved and raised could have participated in an atrocity like this. What could possibly explain his state of mind? Had there been drugs in his system, undetected by the autopsy? Had there been outside influences, organized crime, perhaps? Even if Eric had masterminded a plan and urged Dylan to participate, Dylan was a smart kid. He could have found a way to get himself out of it if he wanted to. Why hadn't he? Had Eric coerced or threatened him? Had Dylan been brainwashed? At one point, Byron asked seriously if Dylan could have been possessed. A month before, I would have laughed out loud at such a ridiculous idea. But in our new reality, demonic possession seemed as plausible an answer as any. We had no gravesite, so I spent hours in Dylan's room, trying to intuit the answers to the questions plaguing us. I was shocked to find a pack of cigarettes in one of his drawers. Not long before he died, I'd thought I smelled tobacco on him and asked him outright if he was smoking. He gave me an exasperated look and said, "I'm not that stupid." It seemed as if he had real disdain for the practice, and I believed him. The cigarettes in his drawer suggested he'd straight out lied. I was also saddened to find a nearly empty bottle of St. John's wort in Dylan's medicine cabinet. I'd been in his bathroom lots of times in the previous months to make sure he was keeping it clean, but I'd never looked inside the medicine cabinet. St. John's wort is a natural antidepressant found at health food stores and drug stores. Here was bald, incontrovertible evidence that Dylan had been depressed enough to try to alleviate those feelings through medication. The expiration date on the bottle indicated he'd had it a long time. I was beginning to appreciate how gullible I had been. Our mail was filled with letters from people, mostly adults, confessing the illicit activities they'd hidden from their parents when they were themselves teenagers. Sexual exploits, drug use, theft. A few of the stories were funny. Foolish adolescent decisions with happy endings. One letter writer had been apprehended by the police on the roof of his childhood home without any pants on. But most were tragic and represented years of painful silence. This collective unburdening was taking place in our own circle of friends, too. Almost everyone who visited told me something they'd hidden from their parents during their teenage years. Drinking and drug use, a road trip to Vegas, years of drugstore shoplifting, a much older boyfriend. Prompted by the events at Columbine, one friend finally admitted to his father and to us that as a young boy, he had been sexually molested by their neighbor over a period of years. I caught myself silently wondering what everyone in the world was wondering about me. How could his dad not have noticed something so huge? We also received a letter, postmarked April 27, 1999, which I recount here with permission of the author, although I have changed names and places to protect the privacy of those involved. It came from Cindy Worth, a woman of about our age. Tom had known her family growing up and had stayed in touch with them through the years. We both admired the Worths. They were successful and happy, pillars of their church, good people, and I was always struck by how loving and close they were to one another. With real sadness and alarm, we read the following. Dear Tom, Sue, and Byron, forgive me for the length of this letter, but there is so much to say. I hope that by sharing my story with you, you will find some comfort and peace and better understand why Dylan didn't talk to you about the pain and anger he was suffering. Mom and Dad moved to Colorado when I was 14 years old. Almost from the start, I was harassed by a group of boys who called me Flipper because my nose is long. They would walk behind me in the school hallways and sing the theme song to the Flipper TV show. They hung used tampons and Kotex in my locker and stole letters from my notebook. They read unmailed letters to my friends back home in the boys' locker room before football practice. The culmination to the harassment occurred when I was raped by a football player. He boasted to his friends that it would have been better had he not looked at my ugly face. I never told Mom and Dad, not until a couple of days ago. I wanted them to know, and I want you to know, why I didn't tell them. It might help to understand why Dylan didn't talk to you about his problems. I felt a tremendous amount of shame about being a target of harassment and assault. I can tell you from firsthand experience that young people blame themselves for the pain they suffer. I believed there must have been something wrong with me for people to treat me this way. I wanted Mom and Dad to think the best of me. I assumed that if I told them what happened, they would think of me as I thought of myself, flawed and ugly. I was too young and confused to recognize that what had happened was a crime. I thought that if I told anyone, the taunting would get worse. I suffered in silence for about 3 months, all the while becoming more and more depressed. I was contemplating suicide when I met someone who literally saved my life. Ken was a funny-looking, outgoing, joyful kind of guy, somewhat of an outsider himself, but it didn't seem to bother him. He sought me out and became my friend. After several weeks, I felt safe enough with him to tell him what happened. This sweet, gentle, 14-year-old boy had enough wisdom to listen and hug me while I shed gallons of tears. Ken grew up to become a minister. He was and always will be my minister. This is what should have happened for Dylan. A friend, a peer, should have been there for him. A friend who could guide Dylan away from anger and depression, not feed it. Please know this. This friend could not have been you, Tom and Sue, as his parents, or you, Byron, as his brother. The process of growing up in separation makes it extremely difficult for children to seek out their parents and siblings for help with these hidden, painful problems. I believe with every fiber in my body and stirring in my soul that Dylan is with the Lord and that we will see him and rejoice with him again. I love you. We love you. We are lifting you up. Cindy. Tom and I reread this letter many times. Tom had known Cindy her whole life. I'd known her more than 20 years. Our children had celebrated their birthdays together. Neither of us would ever have imagined she'd experienced anything such as she described, either the bullying or the rape, or that she'd been so close to suicide. We spoke to her devastated parents a week or two later. They had also been utterly shocked by what they'd learned. Among other things, Cindy's letter validated for us how a child's personal devastation could go undetected by the most watchful parents, teachers, and peers, if they chose to keep it concealed. I had been a teacher at the college level for most of my career and knew well that young adults snuck around, hiding six-packs of beer and furtive smooches in the parking lot. Still, I would not have thought it possible for a kid to hide an event as earth-shaking as rape or thoughts and feelings as serious as suicidal ideation, especially from parents like the Worths. Each day brought a new shock to illuminate how painfully naive and dangerous this belief of mine had been. More than anything, Cindy's letter made me long to talk with Dylan. A running dialogue with him played in my head, like background music in a constant, exhausting loop. In the earliest days at Ruth and Don's house, my doctor had written me a prescription for anti-anxiety medication. I took it only once. The tamping down of my anxiety sent my grief surging full force to the surface. I was unable to stop crying, as if a tap had gotten stuck in the on position. After that, I had decided to live with my emotions without medication. There was no point, I was beginning to realize, in trying to avoid or outrun the confusion or the grief. The best I could do was simply try to survive it. And, in the months and years to come, to do everything in my power to understand all the things I had not known about my son. Chapter 8. A Place of Sorrow. Journal Entry, June 1999. This library had been a place for innocent children, a place where they should have been safe, and now they were all dead. In early June of 1999, we read in the newspaper that family members of the victims were being invited to visit the school library, where many of their children had died, before renovations gutted the room. I knew Dylan could never be considered a victim of Columbine, and we understood why we had not been contacted. Yet we needed to see the place where Dylan had taken his own life and the lives of so many others. Our lawyer spoke to the sheriff's department and arranged a visit. We had been living more or less in hiding since the shootings, so we met the lawyers in the parking lot of a hardware store in order to switch cars. The cloak and dagger routine, for once, did not feel absurd. The school was still a crime scene. As soon as I saw the yellow tape, my heart thundered in my chest. As we walked through the corridors, we saw construction workers repairing the damage Dylan and Eric had caused. Patches of black soot on the carpets, walls, and ceilings showed where they had tossed small explosives as they walked through the school. Ceiling tiles had been removed, and sections of the carpets. Sheets of clear plastic covered shattered windows. Not for the first or last time, I was dumbfounded by the magnitude of the damage my son had caused. Workers looked down at us from ladders, and I wondered if they knew who we were. The library door was locked, covered with a sheet of plastic and swathed in yellow police tape. Before we entered, the sheriff's department told us we were there to see where our son had died, and that was all. I felt grateful for the professionalism of the police and for the respect they showed to all the victims. I was trembling when we entered. Always looking for answers, I wanted to believe that seeing where Dylan and the others had died would provide me with a revelation, some insight. I hoped I would walk into the room and understand something vital about the events of that day and about Dylan's state of mind, and I tried to set my sorrow aside so I could receive any truth occupying the space. The moment I walked into the room, everything fell silent. I could no longer hear the repairs being made in the hallway. I sensed only two things before I was overtaken by tears. I felt the presence of children, and I felt peace. The police led us to the place where Eric and Dylan had shot themselves. My heart caught when I saw the long, lean, angular shape marked out on the floor. Of course that was Dylan. It looked just like him. My tears splashed the floor. Byron's gentle hand was on my back as I knelt beside the shape resembling my son and touched the carpet that held him when he fell. Chapter 9. Life with Grief. Journal entry, August 1999. Quote in the paper about cancer patients. It said, "The people who do well create a place in their mind and their spirit where they are well, and they live from that place." This is what we are doing. Tom's analogy is that a tornado has destroyed our house, and we can only live in one part of it. This is what living with grief is like. You dwell in that small place where you can function. The theologian C.S. Lewis begins A Grief Observed, his beautiful meditation on the death of his wife, with these words, "No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear." Years later, those words still hit me with the full weight of the unassailably true. Any loved one's death, especially the death of a child, shakes you at your very foundation. As Iris Bolton, a suicide loss survivor and author, has written, "I thought I was immortal, that my children and my family were also, that tragedy happened only to others." We need to believe this in order to survive, and the truth laid bare can be terrifying. For me, the incomprehensibility of the way Dylan died magnified these feelings of instability at the foundation of my identity by throwing everything I believed to be true about the life I'd lived, about my family, and about myself into question. One of the students I worked with when I was still at the community college shared with me one of the most difficult things about living with her disability. "Everyone sees the disability first. To them, I'm an amputee before I'm a person," she told me. At the time, I was grateful to her for the insight because I knew it would help me in my work. After Columbine, though, I knew exactly what she meant. I was certain I would always be seen as the woman who raised a murderer, and that no one, including me, would ever see me as anything else. Though I was 50 years old, in the months after Columbine, I felt keenly the loss of my own parents. I was grateful they hadn't lived to see what my life had become, but longed, childlike, for the simple reassurance of their presence. My father died when I was 18, but I was 38 when I lost my mother, and I relied on her long after I became an adult. At her funeral, my siblings and I referred to her as the North Star, a tribute to her unerring gift for helping us to find our bearings in life, even in the most turbulent of circumstances. I suspect that is why, in the months and years after Columbine, I dreamed about her almost as often as I dreamed about Dylan. In one dream I had soon after the tragedy, it was night and a cold wind was blowing. I was searching for my car in an enormous parking lot while clutching Dylan, about 2 years old, in my arms. I tried to wrap a blanket around him to keep him warm as I walked up and down the rows, looking for the car in increasing desperation, but huge, heavy shopping bags filled with papers hung from my arms. These made it so difficult to carry Dylan that I worried I would drop him onto the pavement. Just as he was beginning to slip from my grasp, my mother stepped forward. She said, "Give me the bags. You take care of your son." One by one, she lifted the heavy handles, cutting into my wrists and arms, allowing me to hold Dylan tightly and wrap the blanket securely around him. I found our car and placed Dylan safely in his car seat while my mother stood by, holding the bags she'd taken from me. Then I woke up. The dream revealed the path I needed to follow. The papers in the bags represented everything pulling me away from my grief. Worry about the lawsuits, money concerns, fear of seeing my name in the newspapers, the thousands of letters and bills and notices and legal documents taking over our den in enormous drifts of fear and obligation. It was easy for me to get overwhelmed by the constant media assault, the world's hatred and blame, not to mention my constant anxiety that something terrible would happen to Byron. Our financial situation emerged as completely disastrous and so complicated that it seemed we would never dig ourselves out of the hole. But my mother was right. I had to focus on grieving for Dylan and his victims and let go of everything else. That was difficult. Even if I hadn't been incapacitated by grief, the sheer administrative weight of what we were dealing with would have overwhelmed me. A month after the tragedy, Tom and I were still wandering the rooms of our empty house like ghosts, dazed by loss and remorse, haunted by the same circular thoughts. I miss Dylan. How could he do such a horrible thing? I can't believe I'll never see him again. How could someone I love so much murder people in cold blood? Other children? If only I'd known, said the magic words, done whatever it took to stop him. How could he have done such a thing? And then always, always the impossibility and permanence of the loss. How can it be possible I will never again feel his scratchy cheek against mine? Periodically, we'd be jolted back into a kind of frenetic energy, if not by a renewed realization of what Dylan had done, then by the myriad ways the ramifications of his actions would destroy the home and the life and the family we'd spent 27 years building. Though Gary Lozo significantly discounted his legal services, the first bill we received shocked us into reality. We had absolutely no idea how we would pay it. In that instance, my mother stepped forward from the grave to help us. Before she died in 1987, when the boys were small, she bought life insurance policies for both of them. Dylan's two policies were paid out to us after his death, and they exactly covered the amount of that first bill. It was only a drop in the bucket, though, and there would be years of legal bills ahead. Tom tried to find consulting work in the oil field, but there were few opportunities, and those that did come up disappeared quickly when potential investors learned he was the father of one of the shooters in the Columbine tragedy. Our insurance company took some time to decide whether they would cover our legal expenses at all. When they finally agreed to, we learned they wouldn't cover our working with Gary. This was devastating, as he'd come to feel more like a trusted friend than an attorney, an oasis of sanity in the madness. Starting over with outsiders was emotionally difficult, but our new attorneys, Frank Patterson and Greg Kay, were compassionate and patient with us as we showed them family photos and talked about our lives with Dylan. I needed to feel they knew us as a family, that they knew Dylan. Before long, we grew comfortable with them. Even with their help, each day brought a mountain of incomprehensible paperwork and decisions made more distressing because we couldn't fully understand their implications. Everybody was suing somebody else. There were lawsuits against Dylan's friend Robin, who'd bought three of the four guns, and Mark Manis, who'd sold them the other one. There were lawsuits against the companies that manufactured the guns and against the company that made Eric's antidepressant medication. There were lawsuits against the sheriff's department, the county, and the police. 36 lawsuits would ultimately be filed against us. Our lawyers were meticulous and did their best to explain what was going on, but the complexity of our legal situation was far beyond my ability to grasp it. To be honest, although the lawyers were exercised about it, my own feeling was, who cares? To the extent that the lawsuits would provide a parent with the money to take care of a grievously wounded child, I was glad for them. But the lawsuits wouldn't give parents their children back. They wouldn't return Dave Sanders, the teacher who had been shot, to his family. Lawsuits wouldn't give us the opportunity to do 1,000 things differently, or provide us with an explanation of how the unthinkable had happened. And they wouldn't bring Dylan back. Journal entry, May 1999. Yesterday was terrible. After it took me 4.5 hours to get up, the rest of the day wasn't much better. I cried and cried and just couldn't get it together. I talked to S. in the afternoon and told her I couldn't go back to work after I just told her I could. A month after Columbine, I was on the phone with Susie, my supervisor from work. She'd been terrific about checking in with me on a regular basis, occasionally delivering a meal or a plant tied with good wishes from my coworkers. Years of accumulated sick leave and unused personal days within the state community college system were the only reason I still had a job at all. I was crying, as usual. Susie listened for a while, and then she said, "I think you should come back to work." The idea startled me into silence. Returning to work would be impossible, preposterous. How in the world could I think about anything else but Dylan and the disaster he created? How could I leave the safety of my home and face people who never knew Dylan the way I'd known him, the way I'd loved him? "I can't do it," I said. Gently, she persisted. "Yes, we'd have to work out the details, but it would be good for me, and my colleagues could use my help. What if I gathered a project you could do from home? Something with no deadline you could work on at your own speed?" I didn't have the energy to protest. It was easier to agree than to push back. The innocuous package Susie sent later that week sat untouched for days. Once I began, I could maybe get an hour's worth of work done in a day, and on many days I couldn't even do that. Returning to work for real seemed utterly hopeless. But I needed to reconnect to a part of my identity that had nothing to do with being Dylan's mother, and tackling a project that could be completed also appealed. Our personal lives felt monumental, unscalable. Nothing would ever be resolved, understood, or finished. A work project, even in my severely compromised condition, could be done and done well. So I kept at the little project, even on days when it took me an hour to write a coherent sentence. Eventually, I realized I couldn't do it properly without collaborating with members of my team. As my supervisor had hoped, the small project hooked me back into life, and I began to make plans to return to work part-time. I did so with trepidation. This was a relatively new job for me, and while I enjoyed cordial relationships with my new co-workers, I didn't know any of them well. I worried that they didn't have an image of my son to counter the image of him blaring from every news channel. As for me, well, I was the mother of a murderer. I couldn't stand thinking that the very fact of my presence would re-traumatize my colleagues. The community had suffered dreadfully, and tendrils reached into my workplace. The children and family members of some of my colleagues had been in the school and narrowly escaped with their lives. One co-worker's husband, a teacher at the school, had almost been shot. His close friend, Dave Sanders, died that day. An administrator's daughter was in intensive therapy with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Each day brought a new headline about the investigation, the lawsuits, or the many conflicts brewing over access to information. Even if a coworker hadn't known anyone in the school, how could they be expected to know what to say when we bumped into each other, getting coffee in the break room? How could they know how to work with me? Fortunately, the community college system I worked for had an outstanding leader at the helm, a president who understood the complexity of the situation. She wanted to help me to be comfortable, while simultaneously ensuring my presence would not be unduly troubling for anyone else. A week before I returned, she sent a memo to all system office staff. Anyone concerned about working with me, she wrote, should come to her. A policy was already in place to help employees deal with the torrent of media inquiries, and a counselor would be made available to anyone who needed support. While it was difficult to be the subject of such a memo, I greatly appreciated the wisdom of it. I met with a staffer in the Human Resources Department to make arrangements for my privacy and safety. I was amazed that she spoke about the accommodations as if my experience had been an ordinary setback, like a chronic illness or a parent with Alzheimer's. We asked the receptionist to screen my calls and to erase my schedule from the whiteboard. An administrator offered me her office so I could make personal calls behind a closed door. I slid my nameplate out from its bracket on my cubicle wall and tucked it away in my desk drawer. A day or two before my return, the president sent one more memo, graciously hinting that my coworkers should give me enough personal space to find my equilibrium. She gently cautioned people not to overwhelm me with attention, though they might wish to offer their condolences. I was grateful for this wisdom, too. Even with so much accommodation, my first day back at work was one of extreme emotional fragility. There was no room in my mind for anything but Dylan and the horror of what he and Eric had done. I prayed I wouldn't see anyone in the elevator on my way in, not so much because I felt ashamed, but because a single kind word or touch would make me cry, and I sensed that if I lost control so early in the day, I'd never be able to regain it. Several of my associates had worked from my cubicle in my absence, answering calls and doing their best to sustain the momentum of ongoing projects. I was an intruder in the space. Papers I didn't recognize were stacked in the corner. My computer's password had been changed. Worse was the black telephone on my desk, monstrous to me. For many months afterward, a wave of anxiety would sweep over me when I found the red message light flashing on my phone. But there were no messages that first morning. Before long, people began to pass by. Some offered words of welcome and sympathy. Others gave me a quick hug. I arrived late to our large monthly staff meeting. All the chairs were taken, so I joined the people leaning against the back wall. For the first time since the tragedy, I was in a room filled with people, some of whom I did not know. It was hard not to feel that everyone was focused on me, although they were scrupulously careful not to stare. My stamina was still poor in those early days, and simply standing proved to be too much. A few minutes into the meeting, I found myself short of breath and too weak to stand. I worried that sitting on the floor would look unprofessional, and the last thing I wanted to do was draw attention to myself. But I was going to pass out. So I slid down the wall to the floor, rearranging my skirt over my knees as best I could. I ended up sitting cross-legged behind a row of chairs. One of my colleagues made eye contact and offered his seat. It was a lovely gesture, minimal enough not to embarrass me, but telling me I was noticed and cared about. I shook my head. "No thanks, I'm okay. You stay where you are." I spent the rest of the meeting on the floor, present but not present, watching the backs of people's knees and listening, although I was unable to see who was speaking. Small victories, as they say. I wanted to hide, but I was there. Journal entry, June 1999. I was at work from 9 to 2:30 and made it through four meetings. I fought the whole time to look and act normal. I was slumped down and exhausted. By the end of the day, I was beaten. I have huge, looming thoughts, and trying to get out normal words and thoughts and actions are like trying to push an elephant through the eye of a needle. No one can understand what I've been through or am going through. It's all I can do to even attend or listen. When I got to my car after work, I shut the door and sobbed. Although I did not realize it at the time, returning to work provided an essential framework for my recovery on many levels. First of all, it allowed me to experience directly the compassion and sympathy other people were capable of. It made me cry to be hugged, but I learned to welcome the tears and not resist them. It was easier to allow myself to feel the sorrow than to suppress it. My colleagues walked the fine line of giving me my privacy while still showing compassion and myriad small kindnesses whenever they could. I doubt they will ever know how much they helped me. In July, one of my coworkers came to my cubicle, representing the rest of the staff. In her arms was the most exquisite bouquet of dried flowers I had ever seen. We didn't know each other well, and her manner was formal when she said that no matter what my son had done, he was still my baby, and everyone with children related to my loss. I could see she had no love lost for Dylan, and she probably couldn't understand why I'd loved him either. But she was trying to find common ground. Gratitude overwhelmed me, and I was unable to speak. Later in the fall, there was a craft sale in the break room, and I bought a couple of ornamental Christmas-themed pins to give to friends. I wrote a check and opened my wallet to show identification, but the woman working the cash box assured me it wasn't necessary. "Right," I said, putting my driver's license away, "because who on earth would pretend to be me?" It was the kind of black humor that sustained me in those days. In my awkward way, I was trying to put her at ease, but there was genuine heartbreak on her face. Nobody I worked with spoke to the press, although the calls were constant. One reporter tricked the receptionist into connecting him with my supervisor. Frustrated, he confronted her. "Why hasn't anyone there been willing to talk about Sue Klebold?" "They're not talking because they're good people," Susie told him sharply, and it was true. My first weeks back, I could only think about Dylan. I would cry for most of the long drive downtown in the morning, appreciating the private time to connect with my memories before trying to put him out of my mind so I could function for the day. The last thing I did each morning before leaving my car was look in the mirror and wipe off the salt marks on my cheeks left by tears. Despite the patience of my colleagues and my best efforts to behave professionally, I was a wreck. I was paralyzed by self-consciousness in a way I remembered from my own adolescence. Because I was having chronic intestinal issues as a result of the stress, I was scared to eat in case I suffered an attack without a bathroom close by. I did what I could to reduce my anxiety level. I even stopped setting an alarm clock because the sound would leave me jangly for an hour afterward, to no avail. A friend told me once that the brain on grief is like an older model computer running a program drastically too complex for its capacity. It grinds and stutters and halts over the simplest calculation. It took great effort just to hear what others said. My powers of concentration were nowhere near restored, and racing thoughts about my personal situation and about Dylan kept me in a world of my own. I took copious notes, but no productivity trick could compensate for the deficit. My face still burns when I remember the first meeting I led after the tragedy. I asked everyone to go around in a circle to introduce themselves and say a little about what they did. When the room fell silent, I unwittingly invited them to go around the circle and introduce themselves. Again. The sideways glances and uncomfortable seat shifting alerted me to my mistake. but there was nothing to do but stumble through my apology. It took a long time for me to return to a full schedule. In the same way, my evening walks were helping me to rebuild my physical strength, so did I have to regain the emotional capacity to be around others. Work was a rehabilitation.